day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the podcast from MuseTech.net. MuseTech.net is found on the web at MUSTECH.net. I'm here with my good friend, Darren Morton. Say hello, Darren.
Why, hello, Darren.
And we're back. We're back at you today, and we're going to be talking about a number of subjects today, including a little bit of a preview. I've been fortunate enough to get a beta invite to the new Google Wave.
Very cool
piece of collaborative software. And, you know, beta is a good word for it. We'll talk about that a little bit later, but remind me to tell you the story about Google telling me that my Wave was about to explode.
Good. That's encouraging.
Yeah, it was an exciting pop-up that I had online. working on an article about teachers, what makes a good teacher. More importantly, this list deals with the other side of it, which is, you know, some signs to look out for bad teachers that are out there. We've all had our share of good teachers and bad teachers. Over time, we have our own ideas of what makes a good teacher and a bad teacher, but I think there are some generalities that you can look out for, regardless of the subject, with regards to that. And we're going to talk a little bit about some audio things later, so we'll try not to keep the podcast too long, but we're going to make it interesting.
I like your thinking, sir.
All right.
So tell me about this Google Wave stuff. What is this?
Well, I'll tell you, Google Wave, unless you've been living under a rock and are, you know, and still consider yourself a technology expert, you've heard of Google Wave.
Mm-hmm.
Google Wave is this new collaborative environment that has come out from Google, thus the name Google Wave. And it allows you to real-time collaborate with hundreds of people at the same time. Now, what's really interesting about this is the interface itself is really like a wiki, a WIKI,
mm-hmm.
where you can go in and you can put up a piece of information and then someone else can edit it at the same time. And sooner or later, you're working on a document that has multiple documents inside it that everyone has worked on. And what's kind of interesting about Google Wave is that not only is it a collaborative document, but you see what the other people are doing when they're doing it in real time.
Oh, wow. What a neat twist.
It really is interesting because, you know, it's rather than locking the document or, you know, saying you can't edit this because, you know, somebody else is using this section of it, you literally can see the name of the person working on the document. It's like a little like a carnival race ride, a race game where you have the two cars that are using a squirt gun and they're working their way across. Well, you see a colored piece of text with the name of the person typing, and you can literally race them to, you know, finish mm-hmm. the sentence faster. It's kind of funny. But really, real-time collaboration. Google has some new terms that it's going to be I think we'll catch on because, you know, anything that's Google sooner or later becomes canon.
Yeah.
you know, but one of the terms they use is a wave. What's a wave? A wave is any document that contains wavelets.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. So one wave can contain subtopics that are called wavelets. And then inside the wavelet, you have these things called blips.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Blips. And so if it's not a wave is kind of, you can think of a wave as being the overall document. Inside the documents are, you know, areas that you can enter information called wavelets.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, you know, the wave is about education. You have one wavelet about science, one wavelet about music. Inside science, then, you might have a blip that contained information about a specific branch of science. The same thing inside music. You might have a blip that was about composing or a blip mm-hmm. about theory. Anything inside the blip becomes, well, it's confusing. They call it a document. I don't know. At the end of the day, what it is it's really a lot of nesting and threaded conversations that other people can edit, other people can join. Sooner or later, you will be able to post these entire waves mm-hmm. as applets on blogs or in websites and even workable applets where people can go in and change them. So in a sense, it's like a wiki, but it's way different as far as at least I've worked on many wikis. This is a different environment.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is live. It's flexible. It's fluid. And I believe it's going to change how we do things for a number of reasons. One, it's Google that's doing it.
Oh, yeah.
So it's going to work. Two is it's open source.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's open source, any third party can make applications for it, and it's going to be free to use. So, you know, there's a lot of competing products out there that are very good, But, you know, a school district or a particular organization might not want to use it because they don't want to shell out the money. Well, let's just go collaborate on Google Wave for this project. And I really think that you're going to see that impacting some folks' ideas as to, you know, what product to use. And I think Google Wave will be one of the top choices for that kind of environment. So,
well, the entire Google suite of apps is just amazing. Not to give a gratuitous plug here, but I think most of the folks that I work with use, at the very least, use Gmail.
Mm-hmm.
But Google Docs, I use that back mm-hmm. and forth. The calendar functions,
absolutely.
We use them. They're great. And it is amazing because they are open form, open source. Anybody can add to them.
It really is something, and I have to tell all of our listeners that the person that I owe first learning about Google is this fellow sitting right across from me, Darren Morton. We have this conversation all the time, but I think it's worth it having it again because I can remember being an Alta Vista man myself. You know, we were all using this in the Technological Learning Center. There are all these, you know, really high-end tech guys. And we're all using Alta Vista. You know, we've made fun of Yahoo for years. You know, and Yahoo's a good search engine.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, all of a sudden there's Darren and he's like, you guys should check out Google. We're like, Google? You know, what kind of...
What's Google?
What is Google? What is this? And sure enough, I mean, after that day, it's been Google all the way for all of us.
Oh, yeah.
I teach it in my classes. Better ways to search Google. Better ways to get, you know, the information. You know, when you punch in something on a search engine and you get 20 billion results, if you learn a little bit of Googleese, you can take those 20 billion results down to a couple thousand that are exactly what you're looking for. And Google, for me, yet still returns the best information for what I'm looking for. Although I have to tell you, Bing is making some progress. I've been using Bing just to see what it does, and it's pretty good at returning what I'm looking for too.
Mm-hmm. Now I've typed a couple of things into Bing and come up with search results, opened up another tab and typed the same thing into Google and come up with almost the exact same results in the same order.
Oh, that's interesting. wait, what are you trying to suggest here?
Yeah, a little black helicopter here, you know, a little conspiracy theory.
What are you suggesting? I don't know. Well, and I guess maybe that's it, though. Maybe they're both finally got the algorithms where, you know, let's get the best results back. Because it's a pain. You know, there's new search engines pop up every day. And, you know, my students are like, hey, did you check out this? Did you check out that? And I'm like, no, because I'm going to go to some search engine that's only been out for 2 weeks, type in something and get nothing like what I'm looking for. It's kind of like Google's like old reliable. You know?
Oh, yeah. It just works.
Just works. So
I view Google like I view Microsoft. Like Apple, you know, if people can complain all they want, but you know, there's a reason.
Wait, did you just say that you view Microsoft like you view Apple as far as I can't wait to see what people say about this because Microsoft certainly never crashes.
Yeah, never,
but never,
ever, ever, ever.
We just had an experience today where I was trying at an 8 o'clock brass exam and. And, you know, my sons haven't been feeling well, so it's tough for me to get out the door on time. So I was pushing it. It was 5 to 8. I walked in the door, and all I had to do was print out a list, right? Mm-hmm. What do I see on my computer? The blue screen of death, right? And, of course, you know, rebooting a Microsoft computer is always zippy. Right? So 5 minutes after, you know, I finally get to the point where I can print something. But I hear what you're saying.
But it's ubiquitous. Everyone uses it.
Yeah.
You know, the PCs are the computers for people who actually do work. I think,
Oh, my God. I can't wait to see the mailbag. I love it. This is fantastic stuff today.
Just poking fun at your Mac, folks. Just poking fun.
Good stuff. I have to tell you, though, all my music friends, they've been using the iPod. Not so much the iPod, but the iPhone.
Oh, yeah.
And these applications that are coming out for the iPhone, I'm jealous.
I agree.
You know, because where we live, AT&T, right,
mm-hmm.
Their service is awful. Up here, you know, and so we can't switch to the iPhone just because of the service up here. So, you know, hopefully when they start going to other carriers, I hate to say it, I'm going to switch because, you know, these apps that are available for this iPhone, that especially music, Band in a Box now is available as an iPhone app.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, so, you know, those things are enticing for me as a musician. Google Wave is available as an iPhone. You can do it from your iPhone. You can wave on Google. So, I don't know. I think they at least certainly got that right.
I agree. I agree. You know, my wife's carrying an iPhone, and it just amazes me.
Now, she is. How's her service? Now, here we are talking about, you know, local service.
Well, the cellular coverage, we don't have true 3G around here. And okay. That's the problem. There's 3G service, but it's not quote-unquote true 3G, which is a whole entire series of podcasts in and of itself. So it's just, you know, it's like basically using a 128K modem at best. At best.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, so it works, but it's just there. It just kind of works. It eventually works. You know, start the app and go make yourself a cup of coffee or grind your own bean or maybe grow your own bean.
Oh, you'll have time. Well,
so.
I'm definitely looking forward to the day that that I can say that I have these apps or at least can have a conversation with folks that are running them on a daily basis, you know, as opposed to, oh, poor me.
Well, there's a guitar tuner app. I think that's wonderful.
It's fantastic. I mean, there's a harmonica app for this thing. You blow across the top of it and you can play music. It's really cool. All right. Well, should we segue? Let's do it.
Let's segue.
One of the things I've been working on is you know, it's kind of a touchy subject, but, you know, it's something I think we need to talk about is people that are educating. And one of the things that people don't realize when you're an educator is that that whether you are teaching in a classroom or not, if you're passing any information on whatsoever it may be, even from a business standpoint or, you know, any kind of industry standpoint, you're educating somebody about something. You know, there's a process of learning that happens. I think a lot of times we talk about educators, you know, people just automatically assume that you're talking about folks that are in a classroom, and maybe that's a justifiable or it's a common thought that, you know, it's expected. But one of the things I've been looking at in particular, because, you know, we have a lot of student teachers that go out. We deal with a lot of teachers. I talk to a tremendous amount of teachers, both in standard education and music education, you know, from different states and even some other countries now. And one of the things that I've started to put together, and hopefully we'll have up on MuseTech in the next day or two, is a list of things to look out for, you know, some common guidelines as to why maybe you shouldn't be teaching if you are teaching. You know, here are some things that, you know, I don't want to say necessarily makes you a bad teacher, but these are signs that you could be a bad teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, as soon as you start talking about these things, you know, everybody's defense shields go up, red alert happens, and, you know, people think you're trying to single them out. Or, you know, maybe there are good reasons that, you know, a couple of the lists I have in the criteria might apply to you, but you're still a good teacher. So, you know, you want to paint with a really wide brush. But at the same time, you know, I think we do need to be open about some of these things and realize, sure, maybe there are some reasons that some of these things happen. But the truth is, if you're hitting one or two or three of these categories and you're looking at yourself, then maybe you should think about, you know, maybe doing something else. Maybe teaching isn't a good calling for you. So I thought maybe I'd run down through some of the – I have eight points, you know, with 7,000 subheadings on this, but we'll hit the 8 points, and, you know, and I'm just going to bounce this off of you as someone who is certainly a teacher, but not necessarily an in-class educator, but, you know, you work with students all the time, and of course, we all have been through some type of schooling process, right? So we can all at least relate to this. So my number one sign that a teacher possibly shouldn't be teaching is the teacher really doesn't care about teaching or the student's ability to learn. You know, I think you come across this all the time. You know, the teacher doesn't listen to the students when they ask questions, doesn't provide any time for the students to answer the questions. Teacher doesn't spend any time preparing for their lessons. The teacher looks at having to talk with the student or the student's parents as an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think we can all kind of know maybe some teachers like that.
Yeah, mailing it in, basically.
Right.
And we've all had a professor or a teacher over the years. When you've walked into class, they've started the lesson, you know this is the exact same thing they taught on the second Thursday of the month of October last semester, last year, 5 years ago.
Right.
It's the same notes. It's the same exact thing, and they are just in robot mode at that point.
Exactly. And, you know, and those are the things. Like, you know, listen, if you really don't care about teaching, or, you know, or even maybe you might care about teaching, but you're not really paying attention to the different learning styles of your students, you might need to adjust, you know, some of your thoughts about that. You know, if you don't really want to teach, then don't teach. You know, there's, you know, some of these people have a tremendous amount of background in what they are teaching. Maybe there's a better avenue. You know, if you don't work well with students, or some of the things we'll tie into this as we go down the list. So let's check out the number two. The teacher doesn't care to learn more effective ways to teach his or her subject or learn more about it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a common thing. Maybe I know my subject material, but there's a better way to present it. Maybe I know my subject, but I'm not very effective at getting it across.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, there are a lot of people, to go back to what you said about mailing it in, you know, every day the informational knowledge base increases. And so there's all this new information, you know, and a lot of teachers don't take the time to look at it to see if what they were teaching is still current,
mm-hmm.
to see if maybe there's a new spin on something. You know, and with that, a lot of them don't even like to go to the required, you know, update classes. Well, we're bringing in a lecturer on this. Why do I have to go to them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I already know everything about this subject.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you have a lot of that out there. I'm not saying everybody, you know, maybe 5%, 10%. I'm not even going to put a percentage on it, but something to think about. Here's the big one, and I think we can all relate to this, or not relate to it, but at least know someone who falls into this category. The teachers look at their job as a paycheck and a series of vacations.
Mm.
And I, you know, it's tough, you know, when you're looking at your job as, you know, a paycheck, especially education, you know, that's great. There are some jobs, that's a great, you know, that's okay. I go in, I do my job, I do a good work at it. I leave at the end of the day, I kind of check out. You know, when you teach, there's a lot of stuff that happens outside the classroom. You know, you have to grade tests, you have to prepare lessons, you need to put in, you know, more time than just mm-hmm. when you're in there if you want to be an effective teacher. If you want to be a teacher that gains ground, we just talked about this. Do you want to be the teacher that does their first year 30 times or do you want to be a teacher that every year you're teaching better and more effective than the year before? You just covered that exact sentiment
mm-hmm.
you know, as we went through that. So another one on here, the teachers look at students as an obstacle that they need to deal with on a daily basis. Can you imagine this? Oh, my gosh. I have to go teach. Here's some students in my class.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's a common stereotype. Yeah, you think about that from you know, TV shows like The Simpsons or anything else you see in current culture. There's this concept of the teacher sitting in the break room at mm-hmm. 7:35 a.m. sucking down coffee and just dreading their workday, popping Xanax and whatever. I mean, it's a stereotype.
Right. But there's a reason.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's say, you know, stereotypes are stereotypes. But, you know, sometimes there's a reason that these come out because it's so common.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually ties exactly. See, you and I are on the same brain wavelength today.
Which is weird.
Yeah, kind of spooky. Here's the other one. The teacher uses his or her limited time with other teachers during the school hours to continually talk in negative ways about their students, fellow teachers, administrators, or the school system.
Mm.
These are the ones sitting in the lunchroom, if they have time to sit in the lunchroom. And they're just like, ah. Oh, you know, look at, you know, Charlie, look at Susie, look at what this mm-hmm. teacher's doing. Look at this. Very negative. It's a lot of it, you know, has to deal with just griping to gripe. I would prefer, to be honest with you, you know, if you can have some times to be with a colleague that you spend the time you know, talking about better ways to teach, more constructive things to do. How can you make the learning environment better?
In professional sports, there's a concept of poisoning the locker room, you know, you hear of players, big name players with big paychecks, and they may be the greatest athlete at their specific position, but they are poison in the locker room because they know what's right. They know they know better than the coach.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not getting their share of plays, if they're not catching the ball X amount of times, then they will just run and run and run with that, and they poison the rest of the locker room, and they're
That's
a bad influence.
Yeah, it's kind of like the bad apple,
yeah.
you know, in the crate of good apples, right?
Yeah.
You know, in a sense, though, that's true, though. If you're constantly in an environment where everything is negative, very few positive things can come
oh, yeah.
out of that, you know, environment with that. So I have that and a number of other, about maybe three or four, I go into some depth. So you'll have to, you know, keep looking on MuseTech.net for the post where we even explain these things more. And what I do want to say is, you know, there are certain, you know, you might fall into maybe one of these categories or, you know, you might have, you might think that you do. But the truth is, it's usually not just one category. You know, there's a couple of these things or maybe all of these things,
oh, yeah.
you know, that you run into. But I think that as teachers, you know, we need to take an objective look at ourselves sometimes and say, okay, well, maybe I am in a rut or, you know, maybe I am doing these type of things. And most teachers, the vast majority of teachers want to educate their students. That's why they became teachers.
Mm-hmm.
They want their students to learn effectively. And a lot of times it's just a matter of taking a step back and reevaluating yourself. You know, all we do as teachers is assess. We assess all of our students all the time. Many times we don't take the time to assess ourselves and, you know, and see how can I become a more effective teacher, or how can I do something better, or, you know, how can I even collaborate with my peers and learn what they're doing. You know, in a sense, you know, take a look at the outside, see what works as well. You know, it's not like you are surrounded by four walls and you can't look out. You know, there are a lot of things you can do. So if you want to check out more on that, you can check out musetech.net, and you can follow along in that. I think it's going to be an interesting conversation, and I told you a little bit earlier that I'm kind of a little bit leery of putting those things up because sooner or later someone will come online and, you know, just be completely upset, you know, with you. But that's okay because, you know, I think we do need to look at these things.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fair game.
Absolutely. All right, last segment for today, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk a little bit about technology. You know, it is Muse Tech, but we talk about music, technology, and education on here. One of the things I would like to say is that I'm talking on a pretty fancy-dancy Shure SM7 microphone here. We are in Darren's new, I don't want to say it's his, but he certainly designed it and put it together. We're in his new studio today, and it's pretty sweet. I'm liking being in here. We have we're in a fishbowl. People are watching us as we go by out here, and it's kind of fun.
I think I'm going to put a hat outside and let people throw spare change in it, maybe. You know?
You know, you might get more money doing that than if you were out there playing with your guitar.
Probably.
Oh, did you hear that?
Curse slam. But, no, I usually get money from people asking me to quit playing. So,
oh, yeah. See, well, yeah, well, it's true. It is kind of cool, though. You know, we're sitting here in this beautiful room, computers, microphones. This is the room we talked about a few podcasts ago that maybe some point, even for the college, we'll get some students playing in here and doing some of the live 91.1 yep. FM stuff.
We have the accommodations for such. It was set up from that way from the get-go. Several of the students, had, when this was in the design process, had brought that up. And they said they'd ask about the capability to record some smaller groups maybe. Somebody, you know, a couple folks come in with acoustic guitars or something. So we built that capability into it. And just a matter of cross-connecting one wire, and I'm ready to go with that one.
Well, I think it's pretty sweet. Why don't we talk about that since we're talking about tech? You know, why are we using these microphones in here? And then how would you go about, you know, let's say I had a brass ensemble in here, you know, not too big, but how would we go about, you know, making them sound good over the radio? What would you do if, let's say, next I brought in a group of four or five players?
Well, the microphones we're using right now are Shure SM7s, which are a large diaphragm dynamic mic. And microphones that have a directional characteristic to them, these in particular have a cardioid directional pickup characteristic. Most mics, as you get closer to them that are directional, the bass frequencies increase. It's called a proximity effect.
Is this increasing for you right now?
Well, that's the beauty of these microphones. I'm right up on top of it right now, and it's not much different.
No, it's not.
Than is, you know, I'm a few inches back from it. These microphones are designed with special porting in them, so you don't get that proximity effect. Mm. So it makes them perfect for a radio studio where you expect somebody to be, quote unquote, eating the microphone. They get right up on them. If you have proximity effect, you also get P-pops and that sort of thing. So
right.
These mics on top of the porting also have a large windscreen on top of them to keep the P-pops and the transient noise down. So these are a good mic to use in this context. Now, because they're a large diaphragm, these also work wonderfully on percussion instruments, and they work well on isolated horns and saxophones. I love the sound of an SM7 on a Barry sax. You just point it right down into the bell. It works great. I'm not going to use this microphone to record an ensemble. It is a dynamic. It doesn't have the sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
It may work. It may produce passable results, and if you've got one mic to select, this is a good general mic to have to do everything, but generally speaking, for an ensemble, I'm going to look for some type of a condenser microphone,
mm-hmm.
probably large diaphragm, so it's capable of reproducing a more fuller sound spectrum, and I'm going to probably place that in front of the ensemble, have the ensemble kind of do the semicircle around mm-hmm. it and pull it back. If you see pictures of old bluegrass players or old-time performers standing on stage or on one microphone, there's a tremendous amount of choreography that goes into being able to use that one microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a skill that's almost lost unless you go to some of the bluegrass festivals where they specify there's going to be a mic on stage, and you work around it. And musician groups have to figure out the choreography, how they can balance themselves around that mic. But in this case, because we are in a small studio, I'd probably set up one very good quality condenser, large diaphragm microphone.
Now, what pattern would you suggest for that then?
Probably cardioid.
Okay.
Probably cardioid. If the acoustics of this is a small room, so the acoustics are compromised a bit. So we have some acoustic treatment in the room to keep the ambience down, but mm-hmm. I didn't want to kill the ambience in the room.
Right.
I wanted it to still sound decent and have, you know, some early reflections going on. So if somebody is playing an acoustic guitar, you'd hear a little bit of the room in the mix. So this isn't a typical radio studio. Typical radio studios, you just deaden them.
Right.
Thick foam on the walls, thick acoustic panels.
And sometimes in those studios, you actually, you know, you feel suffocated.
Oh, yeah.
You know, where I don't feel like that at all in this studio.
Yeah.
So it's got a nice feel to it.
Well, I also went with some nice architectural series acoustic panels, too. So.
Yeah, they are colorful.
Yeah. They're crimson.
Yeah, I love
it. GY, you know.
Yeah, I love it.
But so, you know, I'd set up a decent large diaphragm condenser mic in front of the ensemble and have them perform that way. If you wanted to, you could get crazy with it, and you could go with a stereo pair
mm-hmm.
and set them up in what's called like a mid-side pair, which we'll have we'll probably do a podcast at some point mm-hmm. on stereo miking.
Yeah, we've been threatening it for a few times.
So we will do that, and I can explain mid-side pairs
absolutely,
you know, in depth. But just for a performance on the radio, simple condenser up in front of the group, and get the group positioned around it so everyone equals out nicely. So. A little bit of choreography.
Off the top of your head, you know, I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but with the microphones that you have access to, you know, what would you use in your own inventory? You know, we talked about, you know, a condenser microphone mm-hmm. that was a cardioid. What would you try first?
I'd probably start with like an AKG 414.
Okay.
Those are a good large diaphragm condenser mic that just kind of work on everything.
Okay.
In certain contexts, they're a little spitty sounding.
Mm-hmm.
That can be good to certain lower frequency instruments. They work nice on toms,
mm-hmm.
and they also work well with small ensembles. I like the Shure KSM-44s. Which are the quietest microphone I've ever worked with. They have very low self noise.
Wow.
Very, very low. So if you're doing quality or your high quality recording, that's an excellent mic for it. And I like the sound of it. Very neutral.
Yeah.
But you could get into, there's tube condenser mics you could get into. Even some small diaphragm condensers would work.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to use small diaphragm mics further back.
Okay.
So in a small room, I'd probably stick with a large diaphragm.
Okay.
But like a small one, like a Neumann KM-84 or 184 series,
right,
would work nicely if you could get back from the instruments a little bit.
Well, okay. Well, that's fantastic. You know what? I think a lot of our listeners, you know, they're looking for that. You know, you hate to be specific sometimes, but if you name a couple of microphones to try,
yeah.
I think that kind of narrows it down for people because they're looking, okay, well, I know I need a condenser and, you know, I want it to be a large diaphragm, but, you know, what mics, you know, are recommended? And one thing that you have a tremendous amount of experience with is these different microphones and doing all the different miking things. And I think, you know, naming a couple is helpful
mm-hmm.
for folks because then you can look at those specs online and see, all right, well, this is the microphone we have. Is it close?
Yeah.
You know, and as you know, though, looking at specs sometimes it can be hard.
Mm-hmm.
To determine what's better. In the end, you kind of have to try. But a lot of folks don't have thousands of dollars to, you know, out and try some different things. But
we ought to do a podcast sometime on Swiss, what I like to refer to as Swiss Army knives of microphones.
Oh, yeah. That'd be fantastic.
Come up with four or five mics,
yeah.
Talk about where they work and why they're good to have in your locker. And, you know, for a minimum investment, and you can cover so much sonic territory with just a handful of mics.
Let's make that the next podcast.
We'll do that as the next podcast.
All right. Well, I think we've been a little bit long today,
yep.
But, you know, hey, you know what? You know, Darren and I have promised to do more podcasts, and we're trying. That's all we can tell you, ladies and gentlemen. We're both extremely busy people, but we're glad to bring this one out to you today. So without any further ado, I'm Joe Pisano from MuseTech.net, and I'm here with my good friend, as always, Darren Morton, and we appreciate your time and for listening to us.